Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's a saying that if you could sell one of anything to the 1.3 billion people in China, you'd be doing pretty well for yourself, wouldn't you? That statistic is the nub of today's news that China is now the world's second largest economy. Per capita GDP on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on a Monday, everybody. This one is the 16th of August. It might help to think of a given country's gross domestic product, that is, the size of its economy, as a giant pile of everything it produces, all the widgets and widget repair services and widget shipping companies that it has. Today, the Chinese pile officially took over second place. A report of slower-than-expected growth in the Japanese economy dropped Tokyo down to third. The American pile, in case you're curious, 2 to 3 times bigger than China's, depending on how you measure it. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
A soulless economist could quibble with the GDP numbers. They're not adjusted for purchasing power or seasons. But make no mistake, China is springing forward at a 9% clip. Japan, 0.4. China's transformation began 3 decades ago. Clayton Duby at the University of Southern California remembers the early 80s. He married a Chinese national. And at the time,
the standard list of items that you would prepare for your bride would be 3 things that go around: a watch, a bicycle, and a sewing machine.
3 valuable things back then. Today, they're everywhere, thanks in large part to growth from foreign investment, says former IMF economist Desmond Lachman. As for Japan, he says its economy has fallen behind China for good.
Its population is aging. You've got birth rate very low. It means fewer workers relative to their aging population.
The World Bank thinks China will slow down a bit, but even so, it may grow at a 6-8% rate for years, which would help all its people. Divided by population, income per capita remains a fraction of that in America. Going forward, Chip Chaikin at the private equity firm Blue Point Capital Partners is optimistic. He's betting on Chinese shoppers.
Maybe it's because we've all just recently given up hope on the U.S. consumer, but I think there is a lot of optimism in the Chinese consumer. And part of it really is the flip side of what you see in the U.S., where our consumer overlevered. You know, China really is still very much the opposite.
They're just starting to borrow. And if you believe some of the prognosticators, they could pass the U.S. in total output in 10 years. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Speaking about borrowing, you have heard or seen stories about borrowing costs all over the place the past couple of months. I know you have here. That with interest rates at all-time lows, this is a great time to get a loan. We were talking about homeowners and mortgages on the broadcast the other day. Now, though, it's companies, corporations that are borrowing money for short periods in what's called the commercial paper market, are paying less than 1/3 of 1% interest. Less than 1/3 of 1%. It's a huge change from the fall of 2008 and the heart of the financial crisis, when commercial paper basically dried up. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from New York.
Companies use these short-term loans for daily needs, things like paying workers or vendors. The loans can be as short as a day or as long as 9 months, but either way, they're considered very safe, partly because only companies with very high credit ratings can borrow this way. Corporations like Google and Merck have been taking out lots of them lately. David Sharfstein's a finance professor at Harvard Business School, and he says in Google's case, it's acting like a bank.
They're borrowing short-term in commercial paper market and lending out long-term, taking advantage of the historically high gap between short-term rates and long-term rates.
In other words, Google doesn't need the money, but it sees an opportunity because it can borrow from the market cheaply and lend out its own cash at a higher interest rate. There's another reason to use the commercial paper market right now. Chris Whalen is at Institutional Risk Analytics, and he says companies want to make sure they can borrow when they need to. One way to do that is to take out these short-term loans just to show that you do pay them back. the way people sometimes borrow money just to build a credit history.
It's never a bad thing to establish a market for your paper and get investors used to holding it in case you need it.
During the financial crisis, the commercial paper market froze up, along with every other credit market. Charles Calamiris is a professor at Columbia Business School. He says it used to be when companies borrowed this way, it was because they couldn't get money from the banks.
Now, however, people are starting to understand that the most creditworthy corporations are going to weather this storm. They're coming out of it.
He says investors are starting to look at commercial paper as an opportunity. They're more sure about these companies' futures, so they're willing to take on a little more risk. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Besides commercial paper, another indicator that would tell us the economy is getting better can be found in the stock market. The pace of initial public offerings has been sluggish at best since the financial crisis scared off a lot of investors. But some high-profile deals are in the works, and they do suggest that IPOs may be coming back. General Motors is the big one. The government-owned carmaker is expected to file its papers this week for an offering sometime later this fall. And reports today say the web video service Hulu is planning to go public as well. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Hulu is owned by NBC, Universal, ABC, and Fox. The website competes with YouTube and Netflix, streaming movies and TV shows like the musical hit Glee.
Mediocre! Hit the showers!
You could say that about the market for IPOs these days, but reports say Hulu hopes to raise $2 billion by selling stock to the public, though last year it made just north of $100 million in revenue.
It reminds me of a rather sizable bubble that occurred about 10 years ago.
That's Porter Bibb with MediaTek Capital Partners. He's talking about the tech bubble, when companies with little or no revenue managed to raise billions in the stock market. There's no telling whether Hulu could raise that kind of money, but analysts are seeing signs of life in the IPO market. In addition to GM, Toys R Us, hospital chain HCA, and internet phone service Skype plan to go public. Matt Therrien tracks IPOs for Renaissance Capital.
In 2010 so far, the U.S. market has already eclipsed the total from 2009, so I think that's a good sign.
But Therrien says about two-thirds of those deals have fetched less than analysts expected. Some have suggested a General Motors IPO could siphon off demand for other deals. Bruce Furster is with South Beach Capital Markets. He expects the opposite.
If the GM offering is successful, it will throw off some confidence into the IPO market in general.
He says there is plenty of money waiting to invest in a new General Motors at the right price. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Speaking of prices, after all of last week's sound and fury, mostly, traders didn't really do much of anything today. The major indices closed pretty much flat. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today's news about General Motors and its pending IPO is welcome indeed in and around Detroit, Michigan. Anything that's good for GM, the theory being, has to be good for Detroit. After years on the decline, thanks in large part to the auto industry's troubles, things may finally be turning around in Detroit. The insurance giant Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is planning to move 3,000 workers into the city next year. And today, the country's biggest online mortgage company is relocating to downtown Detroit, too. From Michigan Radio, Sarah Hewlett reports.
The smell of fresh paint, carpet glue, and drywall dust hang in the air as Bill Emerson, CEO of Quicken Loans, surveys his new corporate headquarters.
We're actually standing, I think, in the lobby, kind of standing on a nice little artistic version of some word that I can't read.
The word is Quicken, rendered in graffiti script on the floor. Starting today, about 1,700 Quicken employees will move into this glass tower owned by the software company CompuWare, which moved its own headquarters here in 2003.
We really believe that we can create some momentum around getting technology companies to the city of Detroit.
City officials hope Quicken's move will help revive stalled efforts to redevelop downtown. Early last decade, hundreds of millions in public and private funds went into building two new sports stadiums and giving makeovers to long-neglected streets and parks. Then the recession hit, and the revitalization efforts ground to a halt. So a couple thousand newly occupied cubicles is welcome news, but they probably won't translate into amenities other major cities take for granted and Detroiters long for, like a major chain grocery or department store. Olga Stella is an executive vice president of the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation.
Office tenants are not going to drive significant retail development because large retailers really look at households first.
And so far, there's not much evidence corporate relocations are drawing new residents. CompuWare estimates that only about 200 of its 4,000 employees who work in Detroit live there. Still, some Quicken employees, like Yvonne Kasgorgas and James Patron, plan to make downtown Detroit their home.
This is our place.
Their loft in the former Eureka Vacuum Company building has stained concrete floors and big windows that offer a view of the Detroit Opera House. It sits above a busy restaurant and a brew pub that are popular with young professionals.
We have been coming down and just checking out different bars and restaurants, and when Quicken announced the move, we decided, hey, let's really look at a place we'd like to live.
And they're just a 5-minute walk to work. Local businesses hope the couple and other Quicken employees will help boost sales. One of those is American Coney Island.
I need 3 fries, 1 chili cheese fry.
Grace Quiros' grandfather opened this lunch counter in 1917. Now she runs the business. Quiros says when the sports stadiums opened several years ago, the restaurant's famed Coneys, for the uninitiated, those are hot dogs with chili, mustard, and onion, started flying off the grill.
Huge difference. Huge, huge difference. CompuWare, we saw a difference.
CompuWare estimates its employees have pumped $15 million into downtown's economy through spending on things like lunches and pharmacy trips. Quiros expects to see a similar economic infusion from Quicken.
We already have people coming in from Quicken that say, you know, we're going to be down here. We can't wait because now we get to have Coney Island.
And she's already looking forward to winning over the next wave of new Coney fans when Blue Cross Blue Shield's headquarters open next year. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
Our series, Road Warriors, that's been running this summer, has focused mostly on the soundtracks that business travelers use to get them through all the depressing parts of life away from home. Today, from producer Michael Rayfield, what someone whose work travel is music listens to.
I'm Joshua Smith. I'm the principal flutist of the Cleveland Orchestra. And when I'm traveling either with the orchestra or on my own, I find myself plugging into my iPod to listen to Nature, 1987 field recording by Bernie Krause. I will, if I have to, spend some time on an iPod studying, you know, pieces that I'm about to play. I do a lot of work that way. But I think because of that, I feel sort of a need to escape from music in general in order to relax. You sort of start out with the sensation that you're sitting in the middle of a field. You hear birds chirping, crickets chirring, ponds lapping, and there's a sort of gradual flow towards a rainstorm starting. You hear thunder in the background. You hear a dog barking, roosters crowing. Actually, it has an arc that is essentially very musical. But what I like about it the most is that I don't necessarily feel like I have to pay attention to it. I can just kind of check out and hear it in the background, and that's kind of what I'm looking for. We're on tour, I think a total of something like 15 or 16 weeks a year, playing either in Europe, this fall we're going to Asia. And if I'm not in the orchestra, I can be also traveling for chamber music or solo appearances. So there's a pretty good chunk of a year where I'm on the road. The entire orchestra can be on a plane, and we don't necessarily have to choose to travel with the group, but we often do. And And yeah, I mean, I know a lot of these people really well, and many of them are great friends. And so there are really great things about that. But there are also, you know, times when you don't really, when you don't want to hear, you know, the person behind you talking about what he had for breakfast, or the person next to you talking about how uncomfortable the seat is, because, you know, it's, yeah, it is. It's uncomfortable for me too. There is a sort of aspect of needing to escape, because, you know, essentially we're around each other pretty constantly. I mean, we work together, we play together, we travel together, and so having like little moments where you can escape is important, I think.
There's a whole new music section on our website, as it happens. You can use it to check out what else Joshua listens to besides nature. Of course, the day's music from the program is there, or you can offer up your own playlist. It's all on our homepage, marketplace.org. Coming up.
We're kind of the laughingstock. Now America is looked at as being the leading brewing region in the world.
The international business of brewing better beer. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slid a tiny fraction today, just 1 point, closed at 10,302. The NASDAQ rose a third of 1%, 8 points, ended at 2,181. The S&P 500 ended flat to just a tenth of a point higher at 1,079. Tech stocks bounced today on news of upcoming deals in that sector. Intel announced it's going to buy Texas Instruments' cable modem product line. Intel chipped up 1 2/3%. Get it? Chipped up Intel. Ba-dum-ba. Texas Instruments jumped 1% today. Dell announced it's going to buy a data storage company called 3PAR. That's the number 3 and then P-A-R. Dell stock slid 0.4%, but 3PAR shares rocketed 86% higher. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.57%. It rose to 2.57%. Think about that for a second. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. American Public Media presents Marketplace Minute, supported by Yellow Book 360. Tune in every Friday for Bill Radke's poetic take on the week's news in 60 seconds, available at Marketplace.org. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for July. Also in Washington, the Obama administration holds a conference on the future of housing finance. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner gives opening remarks. And President Obama will be in Seattle talking about the economy and creating jobs in Washington State. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The weather this summer has been extremely unkind to the Russian wheat crop. It's been badly damaged by a brutal heat wave and those wildfires you've read about. A couple of weeks ago, the government over there announced a ban on wheat exports, giving up the cash in favor of keeping its people fed. The ban went into effect yesterday. Neighboring Ukraine has said it may follow suit, all of which has helped to push wheat prices up 50% so far this year. Same thing happened a couple of years ago with the rice crop, but analysts are hoping things might turn out differently this time around. April Dembosky reports.
Rice crops were threatened by bad weather across Asia beginning in the fall of 2007. One country after another responded by effectively banning exports through hefty price hikes. Thailand, Vietnam, and India all refused to sell rice for less than $1,000 a ton. What ensued was a world rice shortage, one the World Food Program called the silent tsunami. Analyst Jack Scoville watched the crisis from his desk at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Everybody
everybody got panicky, especially the bureaucrats. So once one started to go, all of a sudden everybody else got scared that they were going to have trouble feeding their people, and that's not really good when you're trying to run a country. You know, having people with full stomachs is usually a little better.
Scoble says politicians and traders learned a lesson watching the Asian crisis. He says big wheat exporters like the U.S., Australia, and Canada are not likely to ban exports, and that will spur less panic buying.
I think people are realizing that just because, you know, one major exporter is out for a year, that doesn't mean that I won't be able to get some wheat somewhere when I need it.
Global wheat supplies are much more plentiful now than all grains were a few years ago. Back then, rice, wheat, corn, and soybeans were all trading at record highs. But it's a different economy today. Agricultural economist Daniel Sumner says speculators are tempered by a recession mindset.
I don't foresee us having a sort of widespread commodity price increases going on like we had for the whole set of feed commodities a few years ago.
Even if wheat prices were to double, Sumner says he doesn't expect those costs to trickle down to products like bagels and pizza. That's because the cost of wheat is minimal compared to things like labor and transportation. I'm April Domboski for Marketplace.
I like beer. I like good beer. A lot of other people like good beer, too. Craft brewing, that is, makers of better beer than can be had from Budweiser or Miller, is growing like crazy. Over 100 new craft breweries and brew pubs opened in this country last year. It is a $7 billion industry, again, in this country, which means there's a whole lot of room for international expansion. One of the big guys in craft brewing, Stone Brewing out of Escondido, California, is looking to expand up and out of the U.S. market into Europe, a place known for a fiercely, shall we say, traditional attitude about beer. Thin, watery lagers, mostly. There are a couple of dozen crafters exporting their beer to Europe already, but Stone is looking to actually build a microbrewery on the continent itself, the first American craft company to do that. So, in the interest of getting the story for you and getting it right, I made the difficult decision to take a day off the air, drive down to the Stone Brewery just north of San Diego, and have a look around and maybe take a taste or two.
The brew house is where the active part of the brewing process happens. We mix.
Stone co-founder Greg Cook gave us the tour of where and how Stone makes its beer, brews that are on the denser and chewier side, it must be said. And then we sat down to talk about his plans to expand and about the changing perceptions of American beer.
A lot of people used to think that America was the land of fizzy yellow beer nonsense, strictly. We were kind of the laughingstock of the world when it came to beer and beer culture. Now America is looked at as being the leading brewing region in the world.
So where are we in the Stone expansion process?
We have a colleague who is out over there now, just hit the ground this past Monday. We're looking for a existing brewery site to retrofit their brewery to brew the style of beers that we brew. We'd like to be in a region where people would want to come and visit, good quality of life. But frankly, somewhat of it's in the I'll know it when I see it category.
Why do you have to make it there? Why can't you just take those bottles that we saw inside on the line, put them in a carton, put them on a boat, and send them over to wherever you want in Europe?
We could, but we don't want to for a variety of basic fundamental reasons. One is the time that it takes to ship our beer over there, and our beer is best when it's fresh, and we steward that religiously. Now, when it comes to doing that and sending it refrigerated to Europe, that's extraordinarily expensive. And so when it gets all the way over there, that's going to be quite an expensive equation for the consumer. But I think the primary reason is the carbon footprint. I think it would be irresponsible for us to send high volumes of beer from one country to another and completely ignore the carbon footprint.
Let's get some beers and open them up, and I want you to run me through sort of what you taste and how that might appeal.
This one is Stone Smoke Porter.
Okay.
This is quite interesting. It's, of course, you can see nearly dark black.
Right.
Not quite. It's got a little ruby hints around the edges. We use a little bit of specialty peat smoke malt. Gives a little smoky character.
A little smoky. Not quite stout, but nice. All right. So this is?
Our most popular, our biggest selling beer is Stone IPA.
Right.
And I imagine that probably will also be, if not the highest seller, one of our flagships in Europe.
I could see these two actually selling really, really well over there. Mm-hmm. But you are going into a market where they drink a lot of fizzy yellow stuff, okay? Would you conceivably change the style of beer you make to hit the European audience?
We will be brewing stone and stone-style beers only. I have no idea what the market wants. The market has no idea what they want. I mean, look at what they drink. That's a testimony that they have no idea what they want. Our competition is the limited thinking that people, consumers, have about what American beer is capable of. And it's like the old joke, you know, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is one, but the light bulb has to want to change. You have to be looking and interested, or we're not for you.
How are you going to know? How are you going to know that beyond, you know, the dollar amounts, that Europe has been a success for you?
We measure success in our ability to continue. Are we making enough money to be profitable? Are we making enough money to be able to grow and add? And are we making great beer? So it's a passion play. And part of that passion is we love the idea of kind of going and starting again. And that's exciting to us as entrepreneurs and beer enthusiasts.
Greg Cook, CEO and co-founder of the Stone Brewing Company, talking about his plans to expand into Europe. You know, it occurred to us that we could talk all day about what Europeans may or may not want, but why not just put the question to actual Europeans?
I think American beer is a lot lighter. It has a fizz. If you would have a hot dog or hamburger, you would then associate that with American beer.
You wouldn't go for an American beer. You'd go for Stella, wouldn't you, or Kronenbourg, a European beer.
I think if they can just offer something unique, as long as the quality is good, I think people will take it up.
That was Barry Southern, Matt Wright, and Chris Hubbard at the Shooting Star Pub in London. We put together a slideshow of our time down at Stone Brewing. You can check it out on our website. And by all means, send along recommendations for your favorite beers as well. It's all online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today about the uphill fight that the American automobile industry is facing, GM's looming IPO notwithstanding. Ad Age magazine points out today that Buick is the fastest growing car brand in this country. Sales are up 60% over last year. And Buick drivers are getting younger, too, from an average age of 64 all the way down to 61. So really, maybe it is your grandfather's Oldsmobile. I don't know. And yes, I do know they don't make Oldsmobile anymore, but work with me here on that one, will you? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow slid a point, just a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ up 8 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 gained a fraction of a point. We'll call that, yes, flat. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast, moratorium in one place means drill, baby, drill someplace else.
The rest of the world's not on a moratorium to drill. The rest of the world's trying to get our rigs, our personnel.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.